This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. Just got back from an exhilarating week of snowboarding in Hokkaido, Japan, and now prepping for an international trip to London for a podcast conference. If you're like me with a passion for travel while you're off globe-trotting, your house, rather than sitting idle, could be working for you, earning extra income that can fund your adventures. My brother-in-law, who actually lives right next door, he is a crowned superhost on Airbnb, and a testament to how manageable and lucrative this side hustle can be. He's got an extra room in his house, so he's not only been able to supplement his income, but also support his travels. Imagine the possibilities for your entire house. Why let your home sit empty when it could be the key to unlocking more adventures? Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. Just got back from an exhilarating week of snowboarding in Hokkaido, Japan, and now prepping for an international trip to London for a podcast conference. If you're like me with a passion for travel while you're off globe-trotting, your house, rather than sitting idle, could be working for you, earning extra income that can fund your adventures. My brother-in-law, who actually lives right next door, he is a crowned superhost on Airbnb, and a testament to how manageable and lucrative this side hustle can be. He's got an extra room in his house, so he's not only been able to supplement his income, but also support his travels. Imagine the possibilities for your entire house. Why let your home sit empty when it could be the key to unlocking more adventures? Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. With all the news lately about the homeless problem in Los Angeles and vaccination drama here in California bringing back diseases we thought we'd gotten rid of for decades, I thought it was high time we started talking about something more cheerful and upbeat, namely dying of something even more horrible, antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. You may have heard that overuse of antibiotics has been creating resistant organisms, or superbugs. But what you might not know is that we're actually not developing new weapons in this battle against nasty bacteria. Today we'll speak with Dr. Matt McCarthy. He's a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and an infectious disease specialist. We're going to learn how these superbugs evolve, why they're so concerning, and why we're seemingly just sitting here with our hands in our pockets waiting to be wiped out by a plague of our own creation. I found this discussion fascinating, and I think you will as well. I met Matthew through my network, and I'm teaching you how to create networks for yourself using our course, 6-Minute Networking, which is free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. And most of our guests here on the show subscribe to the course and the newsletter, so come join us and you'll be in some smart company. All right, here's Dr. Matt McCarthy.
I read Superbugs, and it's a little scary because, of course, nobody wants to die of a plague.
Right.
And nobody's really saying we're going to get a crazy plague, but it's also like we're kind of doing it to ourselves right now.
That's exactly right. You know, I was giving a talk about the book and someone raised their hand and said, you know, in the Bible, they said that locusts were cast upon the earth as a penalty for our poor behavior. And are superbugs something similar? And I had never considered it that way. But in some ways, that's a fair appraisal of the situation, that on the small scale, doctors are prescribing antibiotics when they shouldn't, and patients aren't taking them as directed. And then on the large scale, we're giving antibiotics to cattle in ways we shouldn't, and pigs and chickens. We're using tuberculosis drugs in our orange farms. There's a front page story in the New York Times 2 weeks ago that tuberculosis and syphilis drugs are being used for the orange crop because it helps them grow. We use our precious fungal drugs in tulip gardens in the Netherlands. There is a whole array of ways in which we could do better with these important drugs to prevent the spread of superbugs. But in many ways, we're causing their existence.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. So it's not like this higher power thrusting this upon us. It's like, hey, if you use this and abuse this, you're going to have a problem. It's like drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we have to get better at is teaching doctors how to use these drugs. And we have people called antibiotic stewards. It's in many hospitals, but not in every hospital. And it's when a doctor prescribes a valuable antibiotic, there's a check in place, and that's a steward has to approve it. And so sometimes, I've been the steward, you say, no, you're using an antibiotic in a way it shouldn't. And we have to tell the doctor, use something else. And that can sometimes be a delicate conversation to have because the doctor doesn't necessarily want to use something else.
Right.
They want to use what they have.
So this antibiotic steward is, if you prescribe me some kind of crazy Cipro or whatever, times 10, whatever, new drug, somebody might go, whoa, this guy has a gut infection that could be probably cured by something lighter weight. Don't use the nuclear option.
100%. That's exactly what a steward is. And many people don't even know that that is a job that exists.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Yeah, and it's a job that is often unpaid. Oh. I did it nights and weekends when I was an infectious disease fellow. And you end up having these conversations with doctors who sometimes can be very frustrated, right? They're, imagine it's a surgeon who's done the same type of surgery for 10 years and wants to put the patient on an antibiotic that you've used for 10 years. And then a guy like me says, no, that's actually not the right choice.
20 years younger
yeah,
than him.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, look here, you little whippersnapper.
Yeah, and so they say, what are you talking about? Who are you?
Yeah.
And I said, this is the wrong choice. You need to use something else. And then that surgeon has to go back to their patient and say, actually, the steward recommended something else. And that's not something that many, you can imagine, top flight doctors want to hear. But that's a way we protect our trove of drugs. Another way to think about it is, and I talk about this in the book, how hard it is to make an antibiotic and how hard it is to make a profit.
Oh, yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
I've got a whole lot of questions about that.
Yeah.
If you want to.
Yeah, we can go there.
Hold that thought. Because that's what really freaked me out about this was I thought, okay, well, if it's an arms race, we're making new ones. So what the hell is the problem? And we'll get in that. Yeah, there's a whole lot wrong with that process.
Yes.
By the way, you should have heard. You should have seen Howie Mandel, who, by the, you know, he's got a germ thing. He's like,
I do, yes.
So I said, yeah. He goes, well, what else are you doing while you're here? And I said, oh, well, tomorrow we have this infectious disease specialist. And he physically, like, shoved himself away from the table about as far as his chair would go without falling over.
Well,
and he goes, when was that? And I said, it's tomorrow. And he goes, oh, thank God.
Well, so, you know, most people are not afraid of me when I walk into a room, despite the fact that I'm a super bug hunter and that's what I spend my life thinking about and treating. How we really shouldn't know about the op-ed that I wrote about how super bugs are everywhere.
No.
But that is a problem that people don't necessarily recognize, that if you go into your grocery store and swab the meat aisle, you know, swab the chicken or the beef, there's going to be super bugs on it. If you go to
in small numbers.
And when you cook it, those bugs should go away. But they are also in our hospitals and they are in our schools and in our homes. And what I wanted to write about is the fact that just because a super bug is in this room doesn't mean our lives are in danger. And that to understand the risk and to understand how they got here is a way for us to all appreciate what the threat might be. Rather than being fearful, just saying, oh, there are these bugs in our environment and we have immune systems that protect us. Sometimes they get the upper hand. And I wanted to write about how they get the upper hand so that we can all sort of be on the same page about this discussion.
Is it kind of a critical mass thing? Is it like if you're at a concert and there's one criminal or a pickpocket, chances are you're going to be fine. But if there's more criminals than there are normal people, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's a fair way of describing it. You know, many people have a super bug called MRSA on their skin, and you could live your entire life with that MRSA never affecting you at all, period.
MRSA is a antibiotic antibiotic resistant staph.
That's exactly right, and it's often resistant to oral antibiotics. Not always, but we increasingly have to use intravenous treatments. And patients can have that on their skin for years, no problem. And then one day you get a big cut, and some of that MRSA seeps into your skin, gets into your blood, and we got a big problem. And the more you have on your skin, the more likely it is to get under into your blood. And once it's in the blood, it can go all over the place. And that's where it gets dangerous.
When I was in Egypt, literally 20 years ago, I had all these cuts on my feet because I had sandals. And I stepped in numerous puddles of really like gross camel pee and everything that's in the middle of nowhere in Egypt hiking. And when I got home, I got really, really, really sick.
Really?
It turned out I had a blood infection that was it was staph or something.
Oh.
But I was 20.
Yeah.
And I was like sleeping and eating and working out. And they were like, here, just take this really potent antibiotic. And I ended up taking it and like overnight symptoms disappeared. But I remember they were like, take the whole bottle.
Right.
So I did.
And that's good that you did. And this is one of the ways that superbugs are created if people don't take the whole bottle. Because bacteria are constantly mutating, constantly evolving. And if you're supposed to take 10 days of an antibiotic and you only take 2, the bacteria get a whiff of the drug and say, aha, here's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Let's create an enzyme to destroy it. Whereas if you take it for all 10 days, you actually just wipe out the bacterium.
Right.
And so it's constantly trying to fight against what we throw at them.
Which is rough because the bacteria's life, how long do bacteria live? Like a few hours and then they evolve? Or
well,
how does it work?
Some can live for decades.
Same organism?
Yeah, yeah. Because they divide very, very slowly. One to think about that divides slowly that's hard to treat is tuberculosis. It's a mycobacterium that could live in your lung.
What does that mean, mold?
It's between a mold and a bacterium. That's exactly right. And it's so hard to treat because it divides so slowly. If something is dividing very quickly and growing very quickly, and you throw a wrench into that organism, it suddenly breaks down and it can't divide the way it wants and it starts making mistakes.
Mm.
The tuberculosis just sits in your lung and hangs out and doesn't do anything. And we have a hard time coming up with drugs that can affect such an inert and just kind of laid back organism. And many people have it in their lungs for years. No problem. And then they get chemotherapy that wipes out their immune system.
Yeah.
And then the tuberculosis flares.
How come some people, this is totally off topic, but how come
I like going off topic.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. People probably only ask you the same set of questions. How come some people have that tuberculosis shot mark on their arm from other countries and I don't have that?
Yeah. So there is a vaccine for tuberculosis called BCG that is used in a number of countries where the rates are so high that they do that to protect them. So whenever you're thinking about a vaccine, just as a blanket statement, the first question you need to ask yourself is before you develop the vaccine is how common is that infection in our society? So tuberculosis is relatively uncommon in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's not cost effective and it's not worth it to give us all the vaccine. The problem with this is that people see a condition now like measles.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, there's no measles, so I don't need a vaccine. And that's actually exactly the wrong thought. The reason that we haven't had measles around for 20 years is because of something called herd immunity. People all get vaccinated and there's no risk to the population. I work in New York where we have a strong anti-vax population. And we also have this other group that hasn't been talked about, which is a number of people will say, I believe the vaccine works. I just don't want to give it to my kid.
Right. So they're, what's that concept in economics? Free riding?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where everybody else is taking care of the common things. So I'm just not going to. But if everyone thinks that way, then no one takes care of the common.
That's right. And one of the arguments now is for the kids who are unvaccinated, whether or not they should be allowed to go into public spaces because they're at risk. They could get measles. And if you say they can't go, is that child abuse?
Right. I think we talked about this on the phone where people were like, oh, well, it's not fair because to ban my kid from McDonald's. But it's like, wait a minute, wait, you don't have like a human right to go play in the playland at McDonald's.
Right. Well, you're right. I think these are the same people who are saying, I don't want the government to tell me what to do and tell me that I have to get a vaccination. They're certainly not going to want to hear the government say they're not allowed to take their kid to the park. And how do you get through to people who don't want to hear what you have to say? To me, it is a lot like having a political conversation with somebody who disagrees with your politics. And I cannot say that I've figured out a way to meet people where they're at and change their minds. I try to meet them where they're at, but then the conversation doesn't always go where I want it to go.
Right. Yeah. Well, sometimes you have to meet people so far outside the scope of kind of rational thought that you're going, it's if I want you to meet me in LA and we're starting in Chicago, it's just going to take longer to get here.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there are a lot of counter arguments that don't make sense to me that I hear from friends of mine that I just think like, oh, I hate that we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
Like, one that I wrote down from my friend, I won't out him on the show here because he's also sort of like, people know who he is. Arguments that he makes are diseases like measles mostly affect the vaccinated, so vaccines don't work. He says, whenever there's a measles outbreak, 85% of those people are vaccinated. And I'm like, well, if that's true, which I'm not sure about, there's another reason for it.
There is a popular paper that is passed around the anti-vaccine community, mm-hmm. which shows that when people come into the emergency room thinking that they have measles, a small percentage of them actually have just gotten the measles vaccine and are having a reaction to the vaccine, having a fever or feeling lousy, even maybe having a rash. And those people may initially be misdescribed as having measles, but they're really just responding to the vaccine. This is a side argument that's meant to confuse people and to mystify things and to cloud the discussion. The simple answer to this is the vaccine works. It's safe. When people don't get vaccinated, we have outbreaks. I'm seeing measles now, and I did not see it 10 years ago. And the reason for that is people aren't getting vaccinated. In my book, I talk more about the bacteria and about the fungi, but you know, these viruses can certainly be just as lethal as any other bacterial superbug. And how do you meet people and say, you know, you really should get vaccinated? It's not as simple as that, as you can imagine.
Right. Yeah, sure. No, if it was that simple, then people would follow that. I'm also not one to be like, hey, we need all these regulations for everything. But herd immunity is one where things like the tragedy of the commons, which we were talking about, if you don't vaccinate, people will go, well, you know, let these people not vaccinate. Then their people will die off. And it's like, well, one, it's not them. It's their kid.
Right.
So there's that.
Right.
But the other thing is my wife is pregnant right now. Mm-hmm. It's my unborn kid that's going to get screwed, or my newborn that's going to get screwed because some dumbass took their kid to McDonald's and now my kid gets the freaking measles.
Right.
From
and one of the things that people have not always appreciated is that infectious diseases are a political issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, how the government should step in and what they should regulate and not regulate. And one of the most important political issues no one is yet talking about now is how we're going to confront superbugs. How are we going to create more antibiotics at a time when pharmaceutical companies are saying, we don't really want to make these drugs anymore because we're not making money off of them. And I talk to people who are on the left and on the right, and they all agree that when they walk into the ER, they want an antibiotic available.
Yeah.
And I think there may be some political will to unite in that common fight.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Dr. Matt McCarthy. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode, so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Dr. Matt McCarthy. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all of the latest episodes in your podcast player as they're released, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. And now back to our episode with Dr. Matt McCarthy.
I don't think a lot of people realize that babies who are not old enough to get vaccinated are super vulnerable. And old people who are hanging out with their grandkids, whose kid goes to school with some unvaccinated kid, whose parents happen to be anti-vax, those are the people that get sick and die.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I never thought about this issue before I had kids. I just kind of went through my life thinking about people who had different thoughts with vaccines than I did. Just like, all right, you know, agree to disagree. And then you have your own kids and you see what measles can do to people or some of these other infectious diseases, influenza. And it can terrify you as a father, as a parent. And it takes on a new meaning that you didn't always appreciate.
Yeah. Cause I think for myself, I'm of good constitution.
Yeah.
Even if I got something like that, I'd probably be fine because I'd rest and I would eat right and I have access to resources and I live in a city where I can go to a good hospital. Might not matter.
That's right.
Or I might give it to my dad, who's 74.
Well,
right?
I think about this too. You know, my father-in-law was getting chemotherapy and we stopped shaking hands and hugging and we just sort of did an elbow bump for that reason. And, you know, you're right. Being young and fit may protect you, but you could be carrying something that you can pass on to someone else.
Yeah. I mean, you're careful in your job, but let's say you work at a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
You might be less careful than a physician, but if you go to you've come into contact with this because your own kid is unvaccinated or his friend is and they were at your house, you spread that to 87 people that you then work with every day.
Right. You know, I'm on the ethics committee, and one of the really interesting ethical issues in medicine is how much culpability someone should have for knowingly spreading an infectious disease.
Or negligently.
Or negligently. Right. But, you know, an example will be if someone has HIV and doesn't use a condom and doesn't tell their partner that they have HIV and the partner contracts it. What is the guilt there? Should that person go to jail? Is it the partner's fault for not insisting on protection, knowing that there is some risk? These are issues that we wrestle with in the medical ethics world that, you know, we often bring in lawyers and clergy, theologians, all kinds of people to try to figure out, you know, when something gets spread like HIV or like measles, what's the blame? What's the accountability?
Oh, man, that's got to be a rough question because everybody's got an opinion on that.
Yeah. The great part about medical ethics is it's one of the few areas in life where I can have a very firm, strong belief that will be completely upended in half an hour of listening to someone else who's got a different take than I have.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting because we've talked about this on the show before, and I always butcher the quote, but I think it was Charlie Munger, who's Warren Buffett's investing partner. And he said something like, the quickness, the speed with which you can change your mind is actually a huge competitive advantage.
Yeah. And this is something that happens, you know, when I walk into the hospital every morning, I am in charge of a team of medical students and residents and interns. And the great part about practicing medicine is that we're always looking for areas where we're wrong and looking to, you know, somebody in medical school once said to me that MD stands for makes decisions, and we have to make 100, 200, 300 decisions in the span of 2 hours on rounds. And we are constantly saying, was this the right decision? And if not, why not? What's the evidence? And that's so different than, say, my political views, where I kind of locked in when I was 18 or 19, and I haven't really changed many of them in decades. That's what's exciting about practicing at an academic medical center, is that we're always reviewing the evidence. And when people talk about fake news, doctors are trained to sniff out fake news early in their career. And I think that it's something that we need to talk more about. How do we evaluate medical evidence to make decisions that impact our patients?
Yeah. Of course, this is in everyone's best interest. Nobody wants somebody who's like, well, you know, my training says this, but I did read something on HuffPo this morning that kind of counteracted that, so I'm not sure now.
Well, this is what medicine used to be. There's an era that we're in now of called evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was anecdotal medicine.
Which is, by the way, like, let's just back up and say, what? Isn't all medicine evidence-based?
No,
it's scary.
Not. Because think about, so penicillin, I write about, is the first commercially available antibiotic. And we started giving it to soldiers during World War II. Mm-hmm. We started giving it to people, and it worked. And it was quickly approved for use. Today, if a new antibiotic wants to come to market, we have to do 10 years of testing, and it costs about $1 billion. Phase one trials, we have to test it in animals. We have to test it in healthy volunteers. All of this stuff takes a long, long time, and companies don't want to take that risk. But we need them to invest in that and to prove that it works, because we can't just have doctors going in saying, hey, I got this new drug, I think it works, I saw it on the HuffPo,
right.
And ensuring that we're protecting people and not exposing them to dangerous drugs.
That leads to a really interesting question that we sort of touched on before, which is, how do you even find new antibiotics? Because discovery of penicillin was what, around World War I or something like that?
So Alexander Fleming, I start the book in World War I, and then it was actually 10 years later, he went back to his laboratory, which was in London, and he was just puttering around, and he stumbled upon a petri dish of a bacterium that had all died in the presence of a fungus. And he discovered that this fungus was making a chemical that could kill other organisms, and that was penicillin. And what we later learned is that beneath our feet, in the soil, there is this tremendous diversity of life. There are bacteria and fungi and parasites, and they're all pumping out little chemicals, trying to kill the other organisms around them.
Sort of territory?
Yeah, like a survival of the fittest. And what we are trying to do now is we have recognized that those chemicals that they're sifting out and they're pumping out can actually be drugs, life-saving drugs. And the challenge is finding them. It's like sifting through a needle in a haystack.
Well, worse, because it's in dirt.
Yeah,
how much dirt is there? It's
right?
Everywhere.
And the question would be, where do you start? You know, do you just look at dirt? You know, there are researchers at Rockefeller University in Manhattan who are sifting through it, and they're using big data and they're using artificial intelligence to try to figure out how do you pick that life-saving drug out. And they're asking for people to send in soil samples. So they'll go look at what's under Prospect Park in Brooklyn, or they will look at, you know, frozen tundra. They'll look all over the world, sometimes, you know, the bottom of the ocean, looking for these chemicals. And then the challenge is you find that drug. It works in a test tube. You then have to spend $1 billion proving it will be safe in your mother.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. And it takes forever. So right. we're bacteria can change and evolve much faster than we can keep up with.
Well, you know, they are constantly evolving. And if we have a lot of antibiotics at our disposal, we can use more than one at a time, which is kind of an interesting concept that, you know, sometimes two pretty good antibiotics are better than one and they can synergize. And so what we as infectious disease specialists sometimes do is we try to mix and match these drugs to create a synergistic effect so that they're stronger than the sum of their individual parts.
One thing I meant to touch on before, so this sort of dot from that a lot of, I say, we call it, my wife and I call it her like immigrant mark, because even though she was born in America, she went to Taiwan at a certain period of her life and they're like, you have to have this. I think a lot of people go, oh, well, in America, we must have a version that doesn't leave a scar. But we just don't have that.
No, we don't. We don't routinely vaccinate people for tuberculosis.
So if her and I are exposed to tuberculosis, she's vaccinated and I'm not?
Yeah. So the difference is, so I treat patients with tuberculosis all the time. Many patients have it sitting in their lung.
Yeah, you said that.
But they're not contagious.
Okay.
Because they're not coughing it up. What happens is it gets in your lung, and your body forms a wall around it. It's almost like an abscess that is just isolated from the world. And it doesn't go anywhere. And so you are somebody who has have latent tuberculosis, which means it's just kind of hanging out. And that's very different than the active tuberculosis, which we think about from like the 1800s, where people would die. We called it consumption back then. And they would waste away and they would go to these sanitariums and they, you know, we didn't have any drugs for them. So we would tell them to just get fresh air, you know, go up to the Swiss Alps and
live in a cave.
Yeah. And live in a cave. And now we have all kinds of drugs, and that is another area where we're racing to come up with new treatments. And there's been a lot of investment from people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a lot of philanthropic drive for more drugs. That's in contrast to some of these other superbugs. We have seen that when philanthropy pours in for HIV or for tuberculosis or for malaria, that we can get results. We don't have that happening now for superbugs. People don't find it to be a sexy topic yet, or may never. And we don't have, you know, Warren Buffett's or whoever saying, we need to put $500 million towards developing new antibiotics. And that's part of my goal here, is to raise awareness so that people see this is a real problem. Mm-hmm. The World Health Organization is saying that by 2050, 10 million people will die every year worldwide from superbugs. That's more than heart disease and cancer.
10 million.
And that's more than heart disease or cancer. And we don't want to be in a position where 30 years from now that's happening and we're saying, well, why didn't we do anything?
Yeah.
We have a chance now to intervene, to invest in new drugs. But this is really the time to act.
So why has there been such a slowdown in new antibiotic discovery? And I know we touched on this before, and you said the approval process takes a year, but there's more to it than
that. There's a lot more to it. You're right. The first thing to think about, and a patient asked me this a long time ago, was why is it so hard to make an antibiotic? And the business model is very different for these type of drugs than for other types. So think about a blood pressure medication. A doctor would prescribe it to a patient and say, take this every morning for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. That's a great business model for a company that makes that drug. Then think about an antibiotic. They're only prescribed in short courses. Doctors like me are very stingy about doling them out. And then even that best new antibiotic is going to eventually wear out its welcome when the bacteria mutate and evolve. And so what you have are companies saying, why do we want to make a drug that doctors don't want to prescribe? And that is the crux of the problem. And what we're finding is that these companies are saying, we don't want to do this. And if we end up getting a drug approved, we're going to charge so much money for it, $5,000 a dose, that we're going to try to recoup our $1 billion investment in a way that we can aggressively recoup it. And hospitals don't have to use these drugs. And in fact, many of the best hospitals in the country will say, that's too expensive. Mm-hmm. We're not going to use it. And that's a shame. That's a dangerous place to put patients, because, you know, what I do every morning is I'm at the bedside of a patient trying to come up with a treatment. And I know that many hospitals are not using the newest treatments because they're so expensive. That's different than heart disease or cancer, where we have the best chemo. If there's a stellar new cardiovascular drug, we're going to use it. But if there's a brand new antibiotic, we may not, because the finances are so tight with these types of conditions.
So drug companies then shift to more profitable diseases.
Mm.
It's weird, but it's almost like they shift to something that's more fashionable, that's going to make more money.
You know, I write about an antibiotic in my book, and the company that makes it also makes Botox.
Mm-hmm.
And they made, you know, $3 billion in sales on Botox last year. And so this presents an opportunity where you can say to a company like this, you know, why don't we make a deal where we can entice you to invest in more antibiotics with some of these profits you're making? And these are called push and pull incentives. So a push incentive is to go to that company and say, your corporate tax rate is 20%. Let's cut it to 15% if you promise to invest a portion of those profits into new antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very popular idea with these companies because it's a guaranteed way for them to make more money and for them to invest in new drugs. The idea of giving a tax cut to big pharma is something that a lot of people don't want to think about.
Right. It sounds crooked.
It does. It does. It's like bailing out the banks. And it's like, why should we have to, you know, negotiate with the terrorists in this case? Then there is the other option, which is called a pull incentive, which is to say, if a company does the investment of $1 billion and they get that drug approved, rather than giving them 5 years of market exclusivity, you give them 25 years.
Yeah.
And that way, no generic can challenge them and they can make even more money off the drug. That is a more appealing way of negotiating for me, because it means that they have to take the risk up front. The downside is that they end up charging more for the drug.
Yeah, and then nobody can copy.
Right, right. And then so some people say, wait a second, why do we have to convince them? Shouldn't big pharma be wanting to make antibiotics if we all need them?
Right. Like, hey, look, if these super bugs are going to kill 10 million people a year, how is that not a profitable problem?
Right. And what I quote a CEO in my book as saying, he said, I have an ethical mandate to charge as much money as possible for the antibiotics that I make, because I am accountable to shareholders and not to patients. And that is a dangerous thing to say, but it makes us realize just how difficult this is going to be. That these people are saying, we're accountable not to your patients, Dr. McCarthy, it's to these investors. And these investors don't want to go down this road, and that's going to leave people in the lurch.
It really is, because it's not short-term profitable. And especially because, as you mentioned in the book, in Superbugs, the antibiotics are short courses. So like, you don't need 3 years worth of this drug or even 3 months half the time. You need like 2 weeks or a month.
And you know, there's another school of thought, which is to say, the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want to make these drugs. Well, good riddance. We should nationalize the production.
Yeah, well, you're talking to the wrong guy for that.
I'll tell you, that theory is gaining traction in England. And the idea is that we should look at antibiotics the way we look at electricity or water as a public good.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, if you talk to investors, they say, this is a disaster. And it's going to curb innovation, and it's never going to work. And there's some argument to say it will not work. In England, they've tried this, and it has not been a success. And I think that what we really need to do is focus on enticing the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. As unpalatable as it might be, private companies that know how to make money are the best people to come up with innovations that they can get out in a short period of time.
I agree. And I'm no economist. You know, I'm a physician and a researcher. But when you talk to the experts in the National Institute of Health and you talk to the top scientists, they say, we need this pharmaceutical partner, that the federal government is very good at investing in scientists who can make these discoveries. But then we need private industry to then develop it. And, you know, I quote the head of one of the federal agencies who says, people don't realize that the pharmaceutical industry has perfected many difficult aspects of drug development. You know, the making sure that the lot is not contaminated, and that the distribution and the marketing and these things that they do well. And they say, I work in the federal government. You don't want the federal government doing this aspect. Yeah. And so that's, to me, a really interesting political decision or conversation that we're going to be having in 2020 is the antibiotic market is broken. What are you going to do to fix it? Mm-hmm. You know, what is a candidate's idea? What is their plan? Because you're going to learn a lot about how they see healthcare and the government's role in it by how they answer that question. And it's a question that no one is asking the candidates yet. Everyone in medicine recognizes we're at this breaking point where we need new drugs. What are the plans? I can't wait to hear them.
Yeah, I myself am curious. The other problem with the drugs, and you mentioned this also in Superbugs, is they eventually become obsolete. So it's not like, it's not Botox. I don't know. Maybe you can become immune to Botox too, but it just stops working
right
everywhere because the bacteria has evolved. So it's like, oops.
Right. No. And that's yet another part of this, that those blood pressure drugs aren't just like wearing out,
right,
but these antibiotics. And so when people say that they're different, it's true. It is different than, you know, a cholesterol medication. And the enticements that we have, I think, need to be pretty aggressive because the market is so slim. And what's going to be tricky about these negotiations is big pharma is going to look so bad after the opiate trial that's going on in Oklahoma. And some of these other revelations are going to come out that it may be tricky to go to, you know, Johnson & Johnson is on trial right now in Oklahoma for the opiate way they've marketed that stuff, to go to them and say, hey, could we give you a tax cut so that you go back to making antibiotics?
Yeah.
Because you were really good at that a few years ago. But those are the conversations we may be having.
I mean, that to me is this. It's just so not like a black and white situation. There's not some sort of clear-cut solution. And the other problem, of course, that you also mentioned is that it's only given to sick people. So Viagra is like, everyone wants a piece of that.
Right.
So that's worth a ton of money, but
right,
nobody's like, oh man, let me get some of that MRSA.
The Z-Pack.
Yeah.
And
let me get some Cipro.
And this is
the
fundamental problem with it. But part of it is also just raising awareness that this is a big issue. And the more people who are thinking about it, the more people who are engaged with it. You know, I sometimes talk with like business school guys or people in consulting. And when they come to appreciate the problem, they get really excited because they're like, oh, this is clearly an important issue that people aren't thinking about and talking about. And they can make a real difference in people's lives.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Dr. Matt McCarthy. We'll be right back after this. Thank you for listening and supporting the show, and your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Dr. Matt McCarthy.
It's amazing how much this stuff does get overprescribed. I went to have my wisdom teeth removed probably, I don't know, 20 years ago or more now.
Mm-hmm.
And the oral surgeon said, oh man, did you have tetracycline when you were younger? And I said, how do you know? And he goes, the inside of your teeth are completely brown from this. And he goes, why, how much did you have? I said, I took it for years on end as a kid.
Oh my God.
Because my dermatologist was like, yeah, this is a great way to prevent acne. So I took it for years. All through middle and high school. 7 years probably I stayed on this.
Well, you hit on one of the most fascinating parts of the history of antibiotics is that you said that tetracycline was in your teeth. They could see it. And what we have found is researchers who have excavated mummies from Africa are finding that they have tetracycline in their bones as well.
In their bones?
In their bones.
Oh, so is it in my bones, not just my teeth?
It's in your teeth and a little bit in the bones. But the idea is that, you know, a millennia ago that human beings recognized that there was something in the environment that they could eat that would help them, and that we were consuming antibiotics before we even knew what they were. And we found that the rates of infection in those communities, in those societies, were lower because they were consuming antibiotics unwittingly.
Where does tetracycline or something naturally occur?
You know, I'm not entirely sure where they got that from. I think that's sort of the next step is when you look at a mummy and you're like, hey, they got tetracycline in there? What,
yeah, that's
how
so
did that
bizarre.
Happen? Then you start backtracking and say, well, what kind of foods, what kind of things were they eating? Is it from plant-based diet? Was it from the, you know, animals? And then the other thing that you mentioned was that it was your dentist. And one of the next big frontiers for us is improving the antibiotic prescribing practices of dentists. You know, I mentioned that in the hospital, we have these antibiotic stewards mm-hmm. who say, hey, Mr. Surgeon, Mrs. Surgeon, you can't prescribe this. We don't have that as much in the dental world. So it's often dentists saying, oh, yeah, I'll just in case, I'll give you a prescription for 7 days of an antibiotic. And that leads to one study found 80% of antibiotics prescribed by dentists are inappropriate.
That's a ton. Well, this was my dermatologist too. So, oh, hey, your acne. Oh, you don't want to get one zit in sixth grade? Here's a, right. something that's going to fundamentally alter the composition of your body forever.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It makes me annoyed because I remember telling my mom, it's probably bad to take a drug every day. And my mom was like, yeah. So we asked her and she's like, it's fine. I'm a doctor. You're just an idiot patient who doesn't know anything. And I'm like, nope. You just want to make money off this prescription.
Wow.
You don't give a crap that my teeth are going to turn brown.
Well, you're absolutely right
yeah.
that there are times where people prescribe things and the patient knows more than the doctor. And I have this a lot where patients will come to me and say, are you familiar with colloidal silver mm-hmm. as a way of preventing infection or probiotics or something that maybe not in my wheelhouse?
Mm-hmm.
And I end up learning a lot from patients just by the conversations we have at the bedside where they say, you know, my uncle is using this new treatment. What do you think? And when I first started out as a doctor, I was inclined to say, oh, well, there's no evidence to use mm-hmm. that. But clearly this evidence-based medicine that we practice is failing people. And when I hear that, you know, people have a good experience with something, I want to learn more about it and then say, oh, has this been tested? If not, why not? And then that gives me an opportunity to try to bring that new idea into the hospital. The good news is we have a check on that, which is I can't walk in with some crazy compound and say, I'm going to give this to all my patients. I have to get approval from the hospital.
You don't make it in your kitchen.
That's right. And so there's an ethics committee. It's called an institutional review board. And it's made up of people who are not biased. They just review the compound that I bring in and they say, you know what? No, we're not
going to.
This is quackery, Dr. McCarthy. We're not going to do it. Or they say, sounds good. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I've written about are my struggles with this IRB where I'm fighting with them, trying to get stuff approved. And then you know, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
If ancient Egyptians had been eating antibiotics randomly or baking it or brewing it or whatever, does that mean that things that I eat now, I'm putting bacteria, of course I'm putting bacteria in my body, but it's living in me until I die, right? Like beer.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So one of the fascinating parts of the human body is that we have over a trillion bacteria living inside our gut. And every time you take an antibiotic, you alter the composition of that. So, you know, if you took tetracycline for the dental or for the dermatologic reason, it also wipes out a number of the bacteria in your gut. Then you drink a beer and you replace it
with
the yeast and replace it with other stuff. And then you have, you know, a hamburger and you replace it with whatever was in that. And so it's constantly changing. And this is called the microbiome. And what people are now looking at is how does that composition of bacteria affect disease? You know, there are thoughts that an overgrowth of a certain bacteria may lead to Alzheimer's or diabetes or high blood pressure. And so that's also one of the next frontiers in medicine is how do we improve our own microbiome so that we don't get some of these diseases? And that's where probiotics come in. People say, all right, so I don't know if I have good bacteria or bad bacteria in there. Why don't I just eat a bunch of the good stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And that's an area that we're constantly studying to see what really is the good bacteria.
Yeah, a friend of mine who's also on the show runs a company called Viome where they essentially test your stool. They do crazy panels. And he found that 99% of the probiotics, they just never colonize your gut. They never make it there.
Right.
Because, of course, your digestive tract is annihilated. I mean, there's acid in there. You can't just eat something that has a living
yeah.
thing in it and then expect it to make it through the
week. Well, I have some buddies who are in investors, and they had an idea, which is that you can do a stool transplant. You can take someone else's bacteria that's in their gut and transplant it into someone else. And they said, what if we got the stool and the bacteria from really rich people or really smart people? And we called it something like Ivy Poop. Ivy League, yeah. And, you know, it never quite took off.
Might want to work on the brain.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, you have to take those pills in a radically different way than you would normally.
Yeah.
Let's just say it's not administrated by mouth.
Yeah, not ready for prime time.
Right, yeah. Can we use something like CRISPR, which we use to edit genes? Can we use that to create new antibiotics? Can we just print them kind of? Or
this is such a great question. The new advancement in CRISPR, which is this molecular scalpel that can cut DNA and sort of rearrange our genetic code, is being used to manipulate viruses. And those viruses can cause bacteria to explode. And this whole thing is, they're called bacteriophages. And so you can find a bacteriophage, you can use CRISPR to chop it up and rearrange it, and then you can target a specific infection. And we just saw that this could work. A 15-year-old girl from Britain, Great Britain, was saved with this approach. And they used three different bacteriophages and used CRISPR to tinker with them, and then they cured her of this infection that was going to kill her.
How did she get an infection that was going to kill her at 15?
Well, she had a weakened immune system, okay, predisposed to it, and it was a bacterium that's in our bathtubs. It's kind of all over the place. But what I want people to appreciate is when you let's say someone forwards you that article and you read it and you say, oh my gosh, we got this new cure for infections, is to appreciate that will take at least 10 years and $1 billion of investment to get that one success story into a generalizable success story where other patients have access to it. And CRISPR is tremendously promising, but the question is, who's going to take that risk? What company is going to say, we are going to put our $1 billion down and try to make a profit off of this? And what we're seeing is that the smaller companies, the startups, are not having the success and can't absorb the failures. There's a company called Achaogen that spent years trying to get an antibiotic approved. And last June, their product, plazomicin, was approved, and they filed for bankruptcy in April. And it's
right after getting approved.
And so what we are thinking is that it's going to be the big pharmaceutical companies that can actually take on CRISPR, because sometimes it'll fail and they can absorb that failure.
That makes sense. Right. Or at least they go, hey, look, this is going to take 3 more years. Fine. We have $100 billion.
Right. Exactly. We'll sell some more Botox and keep going.
Yeah. Good thing we have Cialis. Yeah. Keeping us afloat. So people might go, well, the FDA is the problem. We need to deregulate this. But you had an interesting counterargument about that, because apparently the FDA is not just a pain in everyone's butt. They're doing something important as well.
Yeah, you mentioned you don't like the over-regulation of things, and that's kind of how my approach was. And I started writing this book and doing research on the FDA, and I sent out my manuscript to a number of experts around the world. And one of the common themes I got was, you're way too hard on the FDA. And, when you get feedback from somebody, you can sort of take it or leave it. But when you get 6 people who have expertise who are all saying you're not quite appreciating how hard this is, it made me do a lot more research and come around to this idea that what the FDA has to do is incredibly difficult. And occasionally drugs get approved, and then it turns out they're dangerous. I've mentioned in my book this drug called Omniflox, which was an antibiotic approved in the early 90s. Everyone said, great, we got a new drug. And then people started dying.
Oof.
And the FDA had to not just monitor drugs until they get approved, but then the post-marketing to make sure things are safe. And, people come up with new ideas all the time, and they have to be, as hard-nosed about sniffing out what's real, what works, and what doesn't as anyone. And I use the example of thalidomide in the book, which is a drug that was very popular as in Europe in the 1950s. And one of the companies wanted to market it here. And a single person from the FDA said, we can't approve this, even if it's being used in Europe, until we are certain it's safe. And this one person said no. And she later discovered that thalidomide was causing birth defects.
That's the one where the kids have like no upper arm
that's
and
right.
their hand is
that's
sticking out, or they have like two fingers.
That's exactly right. Oh, and she saved thousands of kids from growing up this way. And she was a member of the FDA who didn't bow to political pressure, didn't bow to doctors and companies who were saying, come on, you're taking too long. Let's go. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a good example.
Yeah, I think in Superbugs, you'd said something like the FDA has saved more lives than penicillin, which is a huge, I mean, think about how many people have had infections that you needed penicillin. Every person in the world has used this.
Right. So, you know, I have a complicated relationship with the FDA where I, you know, appreciate all that they've done. And on the other hand, I'm still constantly saying, come on, I wish they were a little faster.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably ways to speed it up, but maybe they're not ideal.
And they're coming up with new ways where they can fast track drugs for approval. And I think that's the kind of the future of where this needs to go, is to say, okay, not every drug is created equally. If there is one that looks like it may help society and benefits everyone, like, let's give that a quicker review. And I think that's a good plan.
Yeah, right. Like Botox can go a little bit further down the next Botox or Cialis can go a little bit further down the food chain.
That's right.
Than something that helps us kill infections in chronically ill patients.
Yes.
The problem with the FDA, as you mentioned, is apparently there's so much lobbying that the supplement industry is off limits, which I always find interesting because people will market this supplement, you read it, and it goes, not regulated by the FDA.
Right.
The FDA has not evaluated these. And it's like, wait. People take 100 supplements and then get one prescription. I don't know what the actual ratio is, but my closet is full of frickin' supplements and I have zero prescription medications.
Right. Yeah. This is something that has always intrigued me, that it's simply from lobbying efforts that these drugs are, you know, like you go to GNC and they've just got aisles of stuff that is just, it's like the Wild West.
It's complete bullcrap.
Well,
what it is, right? Like, oh, hey, this helps you metabolize blah, blah, blah better so that it gets to your muscles faster. And it's like, well, who evaluated this?
Right.
Oh, nobody.
And I used to take this stuff, you know, when I was like in college and high school, and I would take, you know, creatine and I would take some of these things. And I don't know if they work. I just kind of did it because that's what everyone else was doing. And now I have a very different view of that stuff.
Yeah. I know the FDA originally came about because people were putting crazy chemicals in food and people would eat like, oh, yeah, there's a crap load of preservatives in here that we wouldn't feed pigs, but feed it to your kids every morning.
That's exactly right. One of the first antibiotics to become available in the United States was a sulfa drug. And a company in Tennessee mixed that sulfa antibiotic with some sweet tasting like elixir so that people would enjoy it when they take this antibiotic. It turned out that elixir was antifreeze.
Oh, and get out of here. That's
people
disgusting.
Died and kids died.
Of course. And your cat drinks antifreeze because it smells sweet.
That's right.
Your cat drinks it, it's going to die. There's nothing you
can do. Right. And so this is where the FDA was essentially came from this. Once was a very small group of scientists doing little experiments here and there. And then when this happened, it changed everything. And
so
the company, the FDA was given a lot more resources to actually monitor and make sure that drugs were safe before they came to market, not just afterwards.
You gotta wonder who said, oh, just throw some antifreeze in there.
Right.
Like, how irresponsible are you at that point?
It's one of those things that the person who probably did it probably didn't have a background in chemistry or in anything, right? Just probably some guy.
It's just, that is beyond unbelievable. That's so irresponsible. Because I would never go, you know, I have no background in this, but let's just do it.
Right.
I would go, you know, let's just make sure that this isn't toxic.
Have
at least one person take a quick look at this.
I got some really great advice when I was in medical school that a way to be successful is to be fearless.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know that that's true. Sometimes you have to know your limitations.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're not the guy who should be mixing antifreeze with antibiotics.
Right.
And, you know, it was probably some ambitious salesman. And I think that increasingly people need to sort of recognize where their area of expertise ends.
Yeah, look, if you're selling hair care products and you put something in there and some people's hair falls out, it's like, ooh,
yeah.
You should get sued for that.
Yeah.
But if you're like, this will taste better to kids if we put antifreeze in it,
but, you know,
what
you're hitting upon is one of the things that I find so fascinating, which is the history of human experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it that we test things out on people? And what I like to write about and think about is how we get informed consent from mm-hmm. patients. You know, I show up in the hospital treating people, but I also approach them about enrolling in clinical trials. And what I wrestle with are the people who are a bit too eager to join the trial. And I'll say, you know, we've got this new drug. It's for this condition that you have. And I don't think they even necessarily understand what I'm saying, but they say, yeah, sure, I'll do it.
Well, they trust you.
Yeah.
So they assume that you're recommending it.
Exactly.
Asking.
And, you know, when you have to make very clear, you know, we don't know if this treatment's going to work. And somebody caught me in a really wonderful situation where they said, I just have one question for you. Would you give this drug to your mom? Mm-hmm. And that cut through a 40 pages worth of discussion of what the risks and benefits were. And it was just on a very human level of like, okay, I don't understand what this superbug is. I don't understand what this antibiotic is. Just tell me, would you give this to your family member? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. And then the person said, all right, that's good enough for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Yeah, it is a really good question.
That person was very intelligent.
Yeah,
we need
yeah.
more people like that. I do understand where you're coming from and where they're coming from. Because the conundrum is, how do we get new drugs when it seems like everyone needs proof it's going to work before you can test it on people? But we need to test it on people in order to prove that it works.
Right.
And human trials are really hard to get approved, obviously,
yeah, yeah.
and for good reason. But also, look, if someone's dying of terminal cancer, shouldn't we go, look, this might kill you. Well, yeah, hello, I'm going to die in six
this
months.
Is,
give me the kitchen sink. Feed me freaking right. cheesecake
right.
for a month if you need to.
Yeah, so this is something that is incredibly controversial in medicine. So the argument that you just made, which is I'm dying, so let me try it anyway.
Yeah.
I can get behind that very easily. I think that's a good argument. The counter to that is, if I'm the researcher trying to create the drug, I'm trying to show it works. And I think you're going to die. Let's say I think you're going to die in 2 weeks. I don't necessarily want my drug to be tested on someone who's going to die anyway, because it's going to make my drug look bad.
Oh, really?
Well,
I mean,
this is, you know, I haven't ever been in this position. I'm just sort of thinking hypothetically, why would you withhold a drug from someone who's dying? And it's because if you give it to 100 people who are all going to die in the next 2 weeks, what is the evidence going to be for
right.
your drug?
Your
drug kills people,
right.
it looks like. And so that's one of the reasons we sometimes withhold these things. As a parent, I think about with my own family, I would want to have the, you know, right to try is what this is called. And I certainly appreciate where people are coming from. And that's one of the reasons I like writing about this stuff, is to take it from, rather than have policy proposals or talking about the finances of something, talk about the human beings and the lives that are impacted by this stuff.
Is this your motto, we defend the defenseless, or is that like a...
That is my mentor, this guy Tom Walsh, who I have spent the past 10 years working with. He is a world expert in a variety of infections, most prominently fungal infections that affect kids. And he, you know, that's what he wakes up every day thinking, I'm going to go out and defend the defenseless. And I have tried to absorb some of that from him, because it's such a powerful motto. And he's a very well known in the infectious disease world, but very essentially unknown outside of it. And that's one of the reasons I wrote about him, is I wanted people to become aware of these unsung heroes who are trying to develop new drugs, who are trying to save lives, and sort of look at the challenges that they're facing on a daily basis.
You mentioned in the book that there's a problem, there's a disparity between poor people and poor countries and them being able to get even basic drugs like penicillin. What's going on here? How come drugs that are pretty common are hard to get?
Yeah, so think penicillin is, there is this special ingredient in the making of penicillin that has to be produced by only one of four companies around the world.
Because of patent stuff?
It's stuff with that, but also just sort of these manufacturing agreements. Mm-hmm. And it costs roughly $20 million to keep one of those plants open for every year. And so if a company is not making a profit off of a drug like penicillin, they're not going to continue to make it, despite the fact that we know in India there are millions of people who need penicillin to prevent rheumatic heart disease or to prevent other types of infections or to treat other infections. But these companies that manufacture this stuff are just looking at their bottom line. And they're not saying, oh, look at the sub-Saharan Africa really needs our drug. They don't care. And, you know, we'll see periodically these gestures where a company will make their drug available to a poor area. I always feel very mixed emotions about that, because I'm glad they're doing something, but I always want so much more. And
sure.
It always comes down to a financial decision.
So they can't just ship over excess penicillin from the United States to this to sub-Saharan Africa, or it's just who's going to pay for that?
Who's going to arrange that? And, you know, part of writing this about this story is to just get people to be fired up about it and be like, wait, you're just telling me that penicillin is not available in places where they desperately need it and the drug only costs like a couple of bucks,
right,
and no one's on top of this?
Right.
Yeah. That was the outrage that I had as I was working on this. And many of the mentors who I've been drawn to in life are people like Paul Farmer, who spends his life trying to get HIV drugs and tuberculosis to people in tuberculosis drugs to people in poor countries. And, you know, just the fact that they don't have a voice and trying to give a voice to people who don't have treatment options. And sometimes that's just my patients in New York City, and other times it's people who are, you know, in other parts of the world, and no one seems to care.
That is actually really disgusting in a way. And it reminds me of those commercials from when I was a kid, Sally Struthers being like, for 30 cents a day, and they show dripping something into some kid's mouth, and it's like, now he's not going to go blind.
Yeah, that's right. And the same thing is true of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And we've just got to sort of enter this into the conversation. You know, my angle on this is not that I am fearful. I'm actually optimistic that we've got all of these new discoveries we're finding, whether it's CRISPR or these antibiotics that are in the soil. And we just need people to care about this enough to see it through, to get those discoveries to the patients who need them most, whether it's here or in other parts of the world.
In the book, there's an interesting story about the anthrax attacks and how there's also anthrax in Siberia because reindeer. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, so this is one of the cool parts about superbugs is that they can be weaponized. That you can, and this is one of the reasons the Department of Defense invests in research related to superbugs and to antibiotics, because they realize that this is a real national threat. And I talk about how there was an anthrax outbreak 20 years ago, and it was a disgruntled employee who was mailing anthrax to people.
Where do you get anthrax?
Well, he worked in an anthrax lab.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. Cheat code.
And what ended up happening was we thought this was a one-off, that here was this, you know, crazed person doing this. But then something happened a few years ago, which is that with the climate altering, there was some melting in Russia toward the North Pole, and it exposed some reindeer carcasses that had been frozen for years. And
how many years are we talking about?
Decades.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And inside their carcasses was anthrax. And what we find is that many drug-resistant bacteria could live in one species and kill another one. And so these reindeer may have been just hanging out with anthrax on their skin or in their mouths.
Or just immune.
Yeah. When the ice melted, it allowed the anthrax to get into the community, and we had to airlift people out of Russia to protect them. And so when you think about how our climate may continue to change, and nobody can really predict what that change will be, we may be seeing other types of infections that become more prominent. And anthrax is sort of this case study of what can happen when we start getting exposed to reindeer carcasses.
Yeah. Well, you also said that there's bacteria in caves underground that's been isolated for over 4 million years. There's no way anything above ground is immune to something that's 4 million years old and isolated.
You're right. It's like when Christopher Columbus came to the United States.
And brought smallpox.
That's right, and wiped out all kinds of people. It's the same thing that, you know, you start bringing up stuff from the caves, you know, 4,000 feet underground, who knows what's going to happen. But what we can do to prepare ourselves is to have a more diverse collection of antibiotics, so that when infections happen, we aren't saying, oh my gosh, do we have anything to treat this? We want to be in a position to say, we got lots to treat this, and let's make a plan and cure this right now.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, oh, look, there's a mastodon under this ice cap. Yeah. Let's grab this thing and study it. And then it's like, oh, there's a thing in there that's going to kill half the
planet. That could be a Jurassic Park sequel.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. We have to handle these things with great care.
It just, I know it's like I've been watching too much Discovery Channel or whatever, sci-fi, reading Michael Crichton novels or something. but these things are really thawing out, and there's stuff in there that we've just never seen.
That's right. He's the one who got me interested in writing. Yeah. Okay. He was a Harvard med guy, and I remember being, you know, 10 years old reading Michael Crichton books and saying, I want to do this. I want to be a doctor who writes and follow that. You know, he did a very different type of writing. I'm doing more stuff based on what's happening in the hospitals right now, but he is a mentor of sorts as well.
What about this plague we might get here in LA? I was talking with Dr. Drew last week, and he said, look, Jordan, we got to get these politicians. You're a lawyer. Let's get these politicians on the hook for negligent behavior, because what he's saying is there are rats in the homeless in LA. No surprise there. There's a homeless population in LA that is ridiculous. We've had something like 1,000 deaths this year in the homeless population, and they're getting things like typhoid and the bubonic plague, literally.
Yeah.
And officers that are, we know this because cops are going to the hospital and going, wait, you have typhoid right. or something right. crazy. And how did you get this? Oh, right. Well, I arrested homeless people on Skid Row last week and one of them coughed on me or whatever
right.
it is.
Well, this is one of the, when we try to predict what the next pandemic is going to be, mm-hmm. most people believe it's going to be an infection that goes from animals to humans. Mm-hmm. One that we hear about a lot now is called Nipah virus, which is predicted to be one of the next great pandemics. It's NIPAH, and it is similar to like the bubonic plague and some of these other things, where if you are constantly exposed to animals that are not housebroken animals, that are you know, vermin that should be out in the wild somewhere, and you're getting bit by those or licked by those, that is how an infection can go from animal to man and can wipe out millions. You think about something like the bird flu, you know, avian yeah. influenza, right?
SARS
yeah. And so these things can leap from one species to another. And when you have a large homeless population, they may be encountering, you know, rats and dogs, and wild dogs and deer, coyote.
Yeah.
This is a milieu in which infections can leap from one species to another and cause a disaster.
Yeah, it's not just people getting bitten by rats, but I'm thinking, my friend told me the other day, oh yeah, we have this neighborhood cat, kind of lives outside, but it'll come in my house and it plays with my kids and then we feed it and it goes to the neighbor's house. And I'm like, and then it goes in the woods and eats a mouse, which has eaten, it rolling around in the feces of a whatever
right.
in the woods, and then it's coming into your house.
Right. And what we need to have are just more, more awareness of how this is happening so that we can come up with treatments to prevent this from being some sort of outbreak.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm glad you're on the case. And this is super interesting. Should I shake your hand?
Yeah,
I don't know.
You're okay. You're okay.
All right.
I washed my hand.
Get the Purell, Jen. Get the Purell out. Thank you very much.
All right. That was great.
This is a fascinating episode. At the end, I definitely went and washed my hands a lot. Shook hands with this guy who's just coming. I just came straight from the hospital dealing with experimental drugs and infections. It's like, oh, hold on. What was funny about this episode was afterwards, I told him, because we went to go do Howie Mandel, and it was like a couple of days. It was, I think, the day before. And Howie goes, oh, what else are you doing this week? And I said, oh, we're going to interview this infectious disease specialist. And he kicked his chair back and was like, wait, when is that? And I said, tomorrow. And he's like, oh, thank God. And I said, yeah, we did that on purpose because we weren't sure. And he's like, thank you. I really appreciate that. He was not kidding. I thought that was kind of funny. So he got in my head, and then I did the interview with Matt McCarthy, and he's like, yeah, sometimes I have to tell people that I didn't just come straight from work when I go out on dates and stuff. And I thought that was kind of comical. What do you do? Oh, I'm an infectious disease specialist. Check, please.
Yeah, seriously.
Did I let him have a bite of my rice pudding? I can't remember.
The check and a gallon of Purell.
The check and a gallon of Purell, exactly. The book title, by the way, is Superbugs. Links to that will be in the show notes. We're teaching you how to connect with great people and manage relationships using systems and tiny habits in our 6-minute networking course. That's all free, and that's at jordanharbinger.com/course. Do it now. Dig the well before you get thirsty. Don't try to wait until you need something, because everybody knows you just want to slam the phone down when people who you haven't heard from in 2 years ask for something. And these drills are designed to take a few minutes a day. I wish I knew this stuff 20 years ago. It's all free, and it's at jordanharbinger.com/course. Most of the guests here on the show do subscribe to the newsletter and the course, and you get the newsletter when you join the course. So come join us, and you'll be in some smart company. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Dr. Matt McCarthy. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram, and there's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube.
This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason, the anti-anti-vaxxer, DeFilippo, and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets are by Robert Fogarty, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. I read everything you send me, especially reviews, so please review us on Apple Podcasts so that others can find the show. Go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe if you need instructions on how to do that. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, and that should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time.